From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. It's Here and Now. This has been a day of violent clashes between Israeli troops and Palestinian protesters who've assembled along the fence separating the Gaza Strip from Israel. Thousands of Palestinians waved flags and marched to the border. Some of them threw stones and drew Israeli fire. The Palestinian Health Ministry says at least 9 people were killed and hundreds were injured. AP reports that the injuries came from live fire, rubber bullets, or tear gas. The Israeli military says the protesters rolled burning tires at their troops along the border. NPR's Daniel Estrin is following this story from Jerusalem. Daniel, this started out as a mass sit-in that leaders of Hamas had organized. Why the action? What's the timing?
Today is Palestinian Land Day. It's an annual commemoration for Palestinians to remember the lands that they lost in the 1948 war that led to Israel's founding. And today's events have been building up for many days. Palestinian organizers put up tents along the border fence with Israel for a tent camp protest starting today, and it's supposed to last for 6 weeks. They're calling it the March of Return to support Palestinians' right to return to lands that are today in Israel. The demonstrators said that they wouldn't cross the border today, but that they're going to be inching towards the border as the weeks go on. Israel has been concerned that throngs of Palestinians could cross the border into Israel. And so Israeli officials have been warning Palestinians on social media all this week, don't participate, don't go to the border. Hamas is behind this. This is what Israel is alleging. And Israel says Hamas, the Islamist militant group that controls Gaza, is also financing this, is paying people to go there. Israel's calling it a premeditated provocation meant to fan the flames of the conflict.
So this is culminating, these protests, on May 15th, the 70th anniversary of Israel's creation. Many, in fact, most Gazans are descendants of Palestinians who either fled Israel when it was created or were forced out. So Gazans are trying to make a statement and trying to break a blockade by Israel and Egypt that's been in place for about a decade now. What is that blockade for, and what's its effect?
Well, Hamas took over the Gaza Strip by force about a decade ago, and so Israel and Egypt have imposed that blockade it's a pressure tactic to pressure Hamas not to rule the Gaza Strip. The blockade means that goods like construction materials that could go into Gaza and build homes are Israel severely limits those kinds of materials getting into Gaza. So the economy has ground to a halt. Freedom of movement has been curtailed. It's very hard for people to leave Gaza, to travel out of Gaza. And in the last 10 years that Hamas has ruled in Gaza, it's waged 3 wars with Israel, 3 very punishing wars with many, many people killed. And Gaza has not been fully rehabilitated since the last war in 2014. There's a serious humanitarian crisis in Gaza. There's a water crisis, electricity shortage, and a financial crisis that the Palestinian Authority president has reduced salaries to civil servants there, creating that crisis. It's his way of pressuring his rival, Hamas, to give up control of Gaza. But Hamas is still in control, and people don't see a lot of hope for a better future right now. There are efforts to reconcile Hamas and the rival Fatah party that rules in the West Bank and to unite the Palestinian territories, the West Bank and Gaza. But those efforts are not working. And so a lot of people don't see a lot of hope now, and that could explain why so many people feel that they don't have much to lose going out to demonstrate at the border. And it's been very violent today. And we've seen a rising death toll, hundreds of people wounded, and it's still going on.
Daniel, broader picture of how this fits into the overall peace process, to the extent there is one there.
You get at the point there, Lisa. There is no peace process right now as it stands in terms of peace talks. The Israelis and the Palestinians haven't sat down for peace talks since the Obama administration tried and failed to broker those talks. President Trump says he wants to broker the ultimate deal for Mideast peace, and his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, has been leading peace efforts. But ever since President Trump recognized Jerusalem as Israel's capital, the Palestinians have stopped talking to the U.S. administration. That was in December, and until today, there's no political dialogue. And so the Trump administration says it has a peace plan that it's finalizing and is going to be presenting soon, and yet the U.S. is not talking to the Palestinians, and the Palestinians aren't talking to the U.S.
NPR's Daniel Estrin in Jerusalem. Thank you for the update, Daniel.
You're welcome.
Well, the Wall Street Journal is reporting today that Walmart may be in talks to buy the insurance company Humana. It's a deal that could have a major impact on the retail giant as well as the health insurance market. And it follows a series of deals in healthcare services, including the proposed $69 billion takeover of Aetna by CVS. That was announced in December. Mike Regan is senior editor at Bloomberg News. He joins us now. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Jeremy.
So the Walmart-Humana deal is still in initial talks, but how big could this be?
Well, right. Like you said, that's an important point that it is only initial talks. The Wall Street Journal first reported that they were in merger talks. Since then, our reporters at Bloomberg have found out that, yes, the two have explored a potential merger, but it's among a wide range of other options of how they could partner. And an outright merger won't necessarily be the outcome, although it sounds like it is a possibility. But as far as the question of how big it would be if they did merge, it would be a huge deal. Humana's market value right now is at about $37 billion. So hypothetically, if Walmart were to buy them and pay a premium to that, you're talking about a deal in the $40 to $50 billion range, which is a pretty monster deal. And these two industries are very, very much getting closer together through deals like this and through deals like the Aetna CVS deal.
So why would Walmart want to get involved in the health insurance industry?
Well, you know, obviously, if you're a big public company like this, the way you keep shareholders happy is you have to keep growing. And Walmart's growth, they are very big. They make a lot of money. But that growth element has really fallen off in recent years. Revenue has been growing, you know, in the single-digit percentage for the last few years. I think it even slipped a little bit in 2016. And the reason is, you know, Walmart is so big and so sort of omnipresent throughout this country that it's hard to grow that sort of brick-and-mortar retail business, especially with all the competition online. So they're kind of trying to think outside the box and think of another industry to pull into the Walmart brand that would allow them to achieve that growth that keeps their investors happy.
Walmart has 1.5 million U.S. workers, many of whom receive health care through Walmart. There's also the point that Humana is focused on Medicare, which services one of Walmart's biggest demographics. That would be seniors. So there are clear advantages with Humana specifically.
Right. And remember, there are about 4,700 pharmacies already in Walmart stores. And part of the logic of the CVS Aetna deal is that CVS also runs healthcare clinics right inside the store in many of their stores. So the thinking seems to be that as foot traffic to retail stores is lost to the internet, it may make sense to throw some more health services into the mix at the stores to give people more of a reason to visit. And as you point out, with Walmart customers particularly, it's a demographic that, you know, might not be prone to go to a doctor as much as a more convenient location inside of a store. Not saying that Walmart would take this approach, but I think the CVS Aetna deal has a lot of people sort of thinking that might make sense to combine healthcare and consumer services all under one roof.
There's also Amazon, Walmart's biggest competitor, which just recently announced it's going to partner with Berkshire Hathaway and J.P. Morgan Chase to try to reduce healthcare costs for its employees. What is behind this trend?
Well, I think there's the high cost of health insurance and healthcare in general, and really sort of an outcry to bring those costs down. A lot of demand for that, and companies like Amazon and J.P. Morgan figuring out, you know, we're big, very tech savvy, financial savvy companies. Maybe we can do a better job at this, and it's kind of lighting a fire under the rest of the industry to really provide healthcare at a cheaper and health insurance at a much cheaper affordability to people before the next guy comes in and disrupts the industry.
One more thing, Mike. We talked so much about the giant Amazon. We should also note that Walmart is huge itself. It has $500 billion in revenue now. Charles Fishman, the author of The Walmart Effect, points out that that is about $1 million a minute. So they're still doing well, even in the world of Amazon.
Absolutely. And, you know, Walmart's online operations have become very successful, too. So they're not, you know, giving up the fight in this competition. As you say, still a giant company. So, you know, any company that big has the cash, has the money to take a chance on something like this and try to, you know, really expand outward into a different industry. So it's in a way, it's a very surprising deal, but in a way, it's also not when you think of the trends in both industries.
That's Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Mike, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Another interesting fact, some 95% of U.S. consumers shopped at a Walmart store or on its website in 2016. That's according to NPD.
Lisa Genova writes novels about neurological conditions you might see written about in medical journals. She authored the book that became the movie Still Alice. The film starred Julianne Moore as a Harvard professor who gets early-onset Alzheimer's disease. Her other books feature characters who struggle with Huntington's disease, autism, and traumatic brain injury, conditions that can leave people feeling other and alone. She's just released a book about amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, or ALS, Lou Gehrig's disease. It attacks the motor neurons in the brain and the spinal cord and takes away the ability to walk, chew, bathe yourself, and breathe. Genova's book is called Every Note Played. I asked her how this disease became her next focus. Why ALS?
Why ALS? Richard Glatzer, who was the co-writer of the script and co-director of the film Still Alice, was diagnosed with ALS just 2 months before he read my book and decided that the last thing that he would do in his lifetime here is make this film. And so I got to know Richard in the course of writing the script and directing the film. I got to be on the set. And shortly after we were done filming, I asked him if I could write about ALS next in his honor. And so he became the first person I knew well with this disease.
So he was able to help you through his death as he was directing this film about Alzheimer's. He was able to introduce you to ALS through his own experience.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, you just got me a little emotional there. Yeah, so that was not expected for me. And so now it's like, here we go. I get to, you know, my book inspired their movie, and now their movie inspired my next book.
So the human story that you're telling in this book starts off with a man named Richard, who's an extremely accomplished and renowned concert pianist. I think he's in his 40s, maybe. He's on tour, and he starts feeling like things aren't quite right. Tell us about Richard, who's kind of a sour character.
Yeah, so Richard's a bit self-involved, a little bit of a narcissist. He's a very accomplished pianist, and he has sort of his entire life has been driven toward his success. He begins to experience a weakness in his dominant hand, in his right hand, and that is the first symptom for him with ALS. He thinks it must be tendonitis, maybe it's a pinched nerve, it's something temporary, as most people with ALS think when they have their first symptom. But with ALS, it doesn't go away, and it doesn't stay in the hand. So it will continue to move up Richard's arm and into his shoulder, and he'll become progressively weaker and paralyzed in that hand and arm.
He could see the first slight symptoms easily. And I wonder if you can read a part of the book right now. This is page 21, and set it up for us, if you will.
Yeah, so the people, I came to know 12 people with ALS really well. Actually, 8 of the 12 died before I finished writing the final draft. So this disease does often move quite quickly. And so, yeah, in addition to the weakness, the other symptom that is a tell for ALS are something called fasciculations. And this is just kind of a fancy word for muscle spasms. And they can ripple throughout the body. And I've seen this happen in people. And these fasciculations tend to happen before someone becomes paralyzed, and they're quite disturbing to experience and watch. So here's Richard watching his own. The first bubble breaks the surface, a pop in his left calf. It vibrates there for a few seconds, the opening act, then jumps to his right quadriceps just above the knee. Then the pad at the base of his right thumb flickers, over and over and over. He can't bear to witness this one in particular, the spasm in his dominant thumb. At some point, the twitching in every single muscle group, in his arms, his legs, his mouth, his diaphragm, will stop forever. And so he should embrace the twitching, be grateful for it. The twitching means his muscles are still there, still capable of responding, for now.
You end that with for now because the trajectory of the disease is so clear. Eventually, we see what happens to Richard. At one point, his arms can only hang by his side. He can, of course, no longer play the piano. He can't clothe himself. He can't clean himself. He can't even roll over in bed or scratch an itch on his nose. So completely reliant on other human beings. In this case, the other human being is his former wife, Karina, with whom he had a child and a very tumultuous time. I mean, they had a hostile divorce. But she finds herself taking care of him.
Yeah, so ALS never just happens to one person. There's the person who has ALS, and then there's the person and often people and community who have to take care of that person. So it's a lot of caregiving that has to go on.
And it may be somebody that you don't even have strong feelings for, somebody who you feel
Right.
About.
And so for some, no, they're in the middle of maybe they're about to get divorced. And so ALS becomes the catalyst for people either repairing things and coming together where there might be healing and connection or pulling them further apart.
One of the things that struck me is at the end of the book, you have Lisa's call to action, and you thank people for reading the book and finishing it. And then you say, I also hope you'll join me in putting empathy into action by you ask people to make a donation, et cetera. What's the importance of empathy and action?
I think the two are connected. You know, once we can understand something from a compassionate point of view, so it's not just intellectual, right? If I tell you that 20,000 people are diagnosed with ALS in the United States, that's information. But if you read a story and you can imagine yourself in the other, that's understanding it from the heart as well as the head. And so rather than lose that moment, I wanted to give them a direction. Even if someone donates $10 to a cause, it might not do much. But if a million readers donate $10 to ALS One, we're going to move the needle on this.
Nice to speak with you. Lisa Genova, author of Every Note Played. Thanks.
Thanks so much.
Let's turn our focus now to movie making and to the tax breaks that provide incentives for film production. Those tax breaks used to be available in nearly every state, but a recent survey by the National Conference of State Legislatures found that 13 states scrapped them in recent years. They said there wasn't enough of an economic benefit. In Ohio, though, it's a different story. There's talk of increasing film incentives, and local schools are even taking steps to build up the region's film production workforce. Adrian Ma from WCPN IdeaStream explains.
19-year-old Tyra Cheney loves movies. Like, really loves them.
I love the dialogue, I love the production, I love every single thing about it.
She says she's read over a dozen books about movie making and hopes to work in the industry someday. But she's never actually worked on a movie set until now. Cheney is running down the halls of Cuyahoga Community College just outside Cleveland. A short film is being shot there as part of a 5-week crash course in production. And the goal is to expose students to the essential, if less glamorous, aspects of movie making, like lighting and sound recording. Today, Cheney's in charge of managing props. And she's just realized that one of the key items for the next scene is not on set.
Okay, I've made a slight faux pas, but it's okay. I just have to keep running.
The class isn't just about helping students get a foot on the showbiz ladder, though. It's also aimed at addressing a weak spot in the city's production economy. David Wayne is a writer-director based in L.A., but he's originally from Ohio.
There's a certain minimum standard of training and skill level that crew people need to have in order to do their job. And most of those people don't live in Cleveland.
He says producers often prefer to hire locals because it's cheaper than flying out a crew. So if Cleveland's going to grow as a production destination, that crew base needs to grow with it.
So this is the main entrance here.
One person looking to help fill that talent pool is Frederick Leahy. He heads up Cleveland State University's brand new School of Film and Media Arts. It recently started construction on a 36,000 square foot campus downtown.
And right over here is Studio B, which will be a broadcast studio.
When it's done, he says the space will be tricked out with high-end production facilities.
Sound stages, ADR, Foley, motion capture.
The state's kicking in about $7.5 million to help launch the school. And Leahy says it's a worthy investment. With studios and streaming services investing billions in new content, he says it's a chance for Northeast Ohio to diversify its economy.
Creative content is what there is a market for. And it's not the same as building cars, but you don't need big smelters for creative content.
But it's not clear how much of that content will come here. According to the Greater Cleveland Film Commission, only 8 productions shot in this area last year. 2 of those were commercials, and another was an episode of Keeping Up with the Kardashians.
We're all going to Cleveland! Wait, are you guys so excited?
So, what gives? The Film Commission's Ivan Schwartz says,
we're held hostage by the low incentive.
Schwartz has been lobbying state lawmakers to raise the annual cap for film incentives from the current $40 million a year to $100 million. He's also talking to private developers about building a studio complex near downtown, a place where big projects can come and shoot year-round. Anthony Russo, who's a filmmaker and Cleveland native, says he likes the idea.
There's a lot of strong regional film production centers, and it's like there's no reason why Cleveland can't be one of them.
Although he shot his last 3 movies in Atlanta, he says he'd gladly move production up north if the infrastructure were here.
Please quiet on set. Roll sound.
Back at Cuyahoga Community College, Tyra Cheney is halfway through a 12-hour production day. She says working on the film set has been both exhausting and yet kind of exhilarating.
Like running a marathon. And then imagine winning an Oscar.
And when I ask what's next for her, she says she's heard about a production assistant gig in New York. So if she can't find work in Cleveland, she may pick up and leave.
Good cut, print that.
Good cutting.
For Here Now, I'm Adrian Mott.
Hi, I'm Guy Raz.
And I'm Mindy Thomas.
And together, we bring you WOW in the World,
NPR's podcast for families.
Every week, we explore wild and new scientific discoveries.
We also ride a bird. Find WOW in the World on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.
Wildfires have scorched tens of thousands of acres in Florida, forcing some home evacuations and spreading smoke across much of the state. One brush fire that started last week when lightning struck in rural Collier County has burned more than 16,000 acres so far. We're joined now by WGCU reporter Rachel Iacovone from Fort Myers. Rachel, where is the worst of it right now?
Right now, it's actually above U.S. 41, if you know the area in South Florida that connects us to over in Miami. So they're trying to keep it from spreading out toward the Everglades City area and the city of Naples right now.
And how close are these brush fires to inhabited areas at this point? What kind of damage have they caused?
Right now, it's been one RV and one vehicle so far, but it is near City of Naples, which is largely inhabited, obviously.
Yeah. Are the fires contained at all, or what has the official response been like?
Yeah, I just got off the phone with Samantha Quinn. She's the Florida Forest Service Mitigation Specialist for the Tri-County area, and she confirmed that the Greenway fire is still at 70% containment after the burnout efforts yesterday afternoon. So fire officials were out there and starting a controlled burn to try to get rid of some of the vegetation that could be burned by the fire as it spreads. We're expecting some of the wind shift to actually bring the fire this way because of the front that's coming in this weekend. And so if that happens, it will be headed straight toward City of Naples.
Is this more about lack of water or just a lot of wind?
It is the dry season. Winds have not been favorable this time. But before this, we had the Faca Union fire in the nearby Picayune Strand State Forest. And that's only a few miles away from this. And that one took 10,000 acres. So it's that time of year here, unfortunately.
It's the wildfire season.
Yes.
Now, I was just recently there, and every morning there was just a blanket of smoke in the area. And then at some point, the wind would shift direction and it would go away. But this is one of the busiest times of the year in South Florida. How is this impacting tourism?
It's kind of a known thing here. This continues to happen because if you didn't know, part of Collier County is actually the lightning capital of the U.S. So if you're in this area, in this neighborhood of Orange Tree, right on the edge of rural Collier County, you're expecting it. And like you said, the wind shifts. So it's one day gone bad in your vacation where there's this wall of smoke, but then the wind shifts and you can go right back to the beach and it doesn't necessarily affect you.
There are fires elsewhere in the state, too. On the Atlantic coast, authorities closed the Florida Turnpike in St. Lucie County last night after a wildfire there blanketed the area in smoke, forcing people to evacuate their homes. Is it unusual to see this many fires at the same time?
Yes, the wind shifts, I said, have not been in our favor with all of the fronts that have come in. Some of the nor'easters actually are affecting us. They're pushing the wind in an unfavorable conditions for us down here. It's great. It's colder for Floridians who are used to the heat, but then it makes it drier. And in dry season, it's making things even worse.
So what's the wind and weather outlook going forward? Is the worst of it over?
They are actually expecting the worst of it to come this weekend, which is why the burnout happened yesterday. This is the area of Florida that kind of curves in at the very bottom. So if they head it down toward the tip of Collier, then they can keep it from actually shifting this weekend when the winds are going to be headed towards the population.
That's Rachel Iacovone, who is a reporter with WGCU, joining us from Fort Myers, Florida. Rachel, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
He said, Donald, I called just to say hello and to tell you, did you see Roseanne's ratings? I said, Mark, how big were they? They were unbelievable. Over 18 million people. And it was about us.
President Trump talking about the reboot of Roseanne on ABC at an event in Cleveland. Trump called Roseanne Barr to congratulate her on the high ratings. The Roseanne reboot aired this week after its last season wrapped up 21 years ago. The original show broke ground in its depiction of a low-income household led by an assertive woman. The new version of Roseanne returns to the same family, but in a very different political climate. NPR TV critic Eric Deggans joins us now to discuss the revival. Hi, Eric.
Hi.
So let's talk about these ratings. First of all, 18.2 million total viewers. The highest ratings were in Tulsa, Cincinnati, Kansas City, and the only city in the top 10 from a blue state was Chicago at number 5. It sounds like this did exactly what ABC wanted it to do. It appealed to Trump voters.
Well, you know, I'd be very careful about going from appealing to people in middle America who don't see themselves on television and then saying that that's about Trump voters. I think what this show did was appeal to people who don't see themselves depicted authentically on television that much, and particularly people in the Midwest and in the middle of the country. And that's what we saw. You know, there's a lot of different dynamics that came together to make this happen. I mean, ABC promoted the heck out of this. We saw ads for it during the Oscars. We saw ads for it during American Idol. We saw the stars everywhere. They were at NASCAR rallies. They were on Howard Stern. This is a beloved show that was the number one show on television at its height when the show was originally on the air. And I think a lot of people were just curious about, you know, what did they come up with so many years after the show had left the air. So to take all of those dynamics and reduce it down to people watch because of Trump, I think it may be what Trump wants to believe, but I don't think it's what happened.
All right. Well, the first episode of the new show deals with a rift that has formed between Roseanne and her sister Jackie, played, of course, by Laurie Metcalf. They were on opposite sides of the 2016 election.
How could you have voted for him, Roseanne?
He talked about jobs, Jackie. He said he'd shake things up. I mean, this might come as a complete shock to you, but we almost lost our house the way things are going.
Have you looked at the news? Because now things are worse.
Not on the real news.
Oh, please!
So how does the show address these political divisions?
Well, the sad thing about it is that it really didn't. I mean, basically, we had several scenes where Roseanne and her sister kind of insulted each other and argued about how they voted. And in the end, they came to this sort of uneasy reconciliation where her sister apologized and Roseanne didn't. And it was disappointing to me because I remember the classic show where when they tackled abortion, for example, they did two episodes where it started out with Roseanne's character being very supportive of abortion rights and even pranking a bunch of abortion protesters at a clinic to a really thoughtful examination of it when there was a suspicion that a child that she was carrying might have birth defects or congenital health problems. And also when they tackled race, they did a whole episode where her son DJ didn't want to kiss a girl in a school play because she was black. And then they examined themselves to figure out if maybe they as parents had unwittingly passed on prejudices to DJ that he was then enacting. And so to see them sort of treat this discussion about one person voted for Trump in a household filled with people who either didn't vote or, you know, wouldn't have voted for Trump. And to have it be such an about face for a character that was supportive of gay rights, that was very pro-feminist, that was, you know, against racial prejudice, it just seemed like a missed opportunity. And it seemed like they wanted to touch on it enough to make Trump voters think they were on their side, but they didn't want to really talk about it in a way that would turn off viewers. Was that a triumph of television quality? I don't think so. I think they came right up to the edge and they didn't go further.
Well, and it's not just the fictional Roseanne Conner who supports Trump. Roseanne Barr famously does. And as we heard, he supports her right back. How much can you separate Roseanne Barr's politics from her character's politics?
Well, that's something that we struggle with all the time in pop culture. You know, Roxane Gay has written this really wonderful piece for The New York Times where she says, the new Roseanne show is very funny and entertaining, and I'm not watching it because Roseanne Barr, the person, is toxic and has terrible political views, and I don't want to support her. And I think a lot of people will make that decision. She has said some awful things on Twitter. She's, you know, expressed ideas that some people view as transphobic and Islamophobic, and she's very inconsistent. You know, one minute she's trying to get the Green Party nomination for president, and the next minute she's supporting Donald Trump. So when I tried to talk to her about why the Roseanne character was a Trump supporter and whether that was connected to her own political views, she tried to avoid the question. She tried to get her executive producer to answer it, her co-star to answer it. And then finally, she addressed it directly after I asked her about for the third or fourth time. And I think we actually have a clip of that.
I'm asking you how this storyline came to be and if it was inspired by your own personal real life support for the president.
You know, the Roseanne show is, I've always tried to have it be a true reflection of the society we live in. So I feel like half the people voted for Trump and half didn't. So it's just realistic.
And if that was the answer, you know, why did it take asking the question four times for her to come up with that? I think they were concerned, particularly back in January when they were just starting to roll out publicity for the show, that people would look at her political views and graft them onto the character and react negatively to the show. Now that there has been this big number for the comeback, I wonder if we'll see more of her views expressed in the public space. And I wonder how people will react to that. I think once they realize what the real Roseanne Barr stands for, it might be harder for some people to keep watching the show.
And what about the edge that the old show had? It tackled a lot of social issues 21 years ago, depression, unemployment, LGBT identity, racism. It was also notable to see a working class family with a woman as its head on TV back then. Does the revival have any of that edge?
Oh, yeah. And I think that's one reason why even Roxane Gay said that the show was entertaining. She may have only seen the episodes that aired, but I've seen one that hasn't aired yet. And we're going to learn that a member of the family is struggling with prescription pill addiction. And they already had an episode where they had a grandchild who likes to dress up in clothes that are considered feminine and is sort of exploring dress, but says, you know, he's not gay. And, you know, there's a lot of kids nowadays that are doing that. So I think they have their finger on the pulse of a lot of issues that working class families are facing every day. And I think it's one reason why we saw such a strong response in some of those areas. Now, I will note that the Hollywood Reporter, for example, noted that some places where the show scored lowest was Greensboro, North Carolina. Jacksonville, Florida, you know, Memphis, Tennessee. You know, there are places where there are a lot of working class and working class white families where the show didn't do so well. And the other thing I think people are concerned about, we're always talking about normalization, and there's always a concern that the extreme political times will be normalized in a way that we wind up accepting dysfunction. And I think people of color, I mean, as a black man, I will say that I'm really concerned to see a character like Roseanne express her voting for Trump absent of any sense of what kind of repercussions that will have for the people of color in her life. You know, in the show, she has a black grandchild. Her son has a black wife who's serving overseas. You know, we never see her. And, you know, I wonder, how does somebody like Roseanne sort of reconcile the fact that she's voting for a president who has in some ways been very hostile to the interests of people of color? And to have the show not engage that, I think, is also a failure. I would love to see that debate where somebody who supports Trump is played by a character who also supports Trump, and we have that discussion. But they didn't really have that discussion. They just kind of normalized the view and kind of went on. And from what we understand from the executive producers, they're not really going to touch on it again in the, you know, 7 episodes that remain. And that's what worries me, is we need to actually have a debate, not a pseudo debate. And unfortunately, I think the success of this Roseanne episode has caused people to claim it's about a lot of things that we don't know that it's about, and claim that it's a discussion that hasn't really happened. And all of that now needs to happen.
That's NPR TV critic Eric Deggans talking with us about the new version of Roseanne from ABC. Eric, thank you.
Thank you.
The divide over so-called sanctuary cities is heating up in Southern California. This week, the Orange County Board of Supervisors voted to join a Trump administration lawsuit against the state sanctuary law. The Justice Department filed suit against California earlier this month. It's suing because California passed a measure called SB 54 last fall. It limits just who local law enforcement can question or detain when they're assisting federal immigration authorities. Orange County isn't alone in California in fighting back against the state law. The Los Alamitos City Council has voted to exempt the city from that law, and a handful of other communities in the area are also considering similar measures. Roxana Kopetman is a reporter for the Orange County Register and the Southern California News Group. Roxana, we know that California has typically become a welcoming place for immigrants, but how is Orange County now different?
Right. So Orange County has a long history in the anti-immigration movement. It was the birthplace of Proposition 187 more than 2 decades ago. That was a ballot initiative that sought to restrict benefits to people living in the country illegally, including public education. It was passed by the voters. At the time, it was called the Save Our State Initiative. Portions of it were struck down in the courts, and so it never took hold. But that sentiment in many ways still remains in the county, even though demographically it has changed so much, and we can also talk about that.
What are the demographics of Orange County?
Orange County is very, very diverse, not just with the increase in Latinos in the 1990 census, for example. 64% of Orange County was white. 2 decades later, 44% of the county is white. And we're seeing not only an increase in Latinos, but also in the Asian population. There's, of course, Little Saigon in Westminster. We have not one, but 2 Korean business enclaves in Garden Grove and Buena Park. If you meander away from Disneyland, you can nosh on some great falafel or hang out at a hookah lounge in the Little Arabia neighborhood. So it's a very, very diverse area.
And how have the politics changed over that time?
So Orange County, California has been a Republican stronghold. For a long, long time, it was touted as the nation's most Republican county. But with these demographic changes, we're seeing policy and political changes. So in 2016, Hillary Clinton took Orange County. It was the first time since the Great Depression that this county voted for a Democrat during a presidential election. And now we got 4 congressional districts that are considered potential toss-ups and could flip from Republican to Democrat. So there are changes coming about. The number of registered Democrats in the county actually is on pace to outnumber Republicans, possibly in the next year.
So then what is the main argument that's been brought up against a designation of sanctuary city or sanctuary cities within Orange County and for joining this Trump administration lawsuit?
Well, it depends on what side is explaining how that came about. You know, one side would say that it's political and even call it racist and xenophobic. Another side says that it's time to fight back a state that has circumvented federal law. And they cite things like public safety. They feel that if someone has committed a crime, regardless of the crime, even though they have served their time, they should be deported. So it's more about the rule of law, law and order, public safety.
This is not the first political divide by any means in the state. But what does this particular issue say about California and where it is, at least on the issue of immigration?
Well, California certainly has its blue pockets, its red pockets. People think of California as the pro-immigrant state, as a very liberal state, and I would say it is. But Donald Trump did get nearly 4.5 million votes here. So to put it in perspective, California is a supermajority Democrat state. So whatever divisions there are here, it's a lopsided one. And I think what we're seeing is that those who have felt left out are now having their say.
Is there any expectation that because of a vote like this, things will change on the ground, that people who are in the country illegally, whether or not they have committed any crime, are now at risk, maybe are planning on moving elsewhere? Any evidence of that?
Well, people certainly feel more at risk. This kind of talk spurs considerable anxiety. I have heard of people who are going back to their native country, even including people who have lived here their whole lives. Parents who are here undocumented are giving their power of attorney to other people in case they get deported. We're seeing more people seeking power of attorney so that their children have somewhere to go if they are removed from the country.
Roxana Kopetman is a reporter for the Orange County Register and the Southern California News Group, speaking to us from California. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Lisa Mullins. Robin Young is back on Monday.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.